It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For nearly two decades, the public radio program This American Life has been bringing conversational storytelling to broadcast journalism in a way that has appealed to listeners and critics alike. This American Life just received its fourth Peabody Award for what the presenters called a show which, quote, captures contemporary culture in fresh and inventive ways that mirror the diversity and eccentricities of its subjects and weaves original monologues, mini-dramas, original fiction, traditional radio documentaries, and original radio dramas into an instructional and entertaining tapestry. The man who tells these stories is the show's host, Ira Glass, and he is coming to Pittsburgh on Saturday, April 13th, to appear in Reinventing Radio, an evening with Ira Glass as part of the Hillman Center Performing Arts Series. This American Life airs Saturdays at noon and repeats Sundays at 4 on 90.5 WESA. He joins us from Chicago. Ira Glass, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, nice to be here.
Reinventing Radio, pretty heady stuff. Do you feel that creating This American Life has in some way reinvented radio or contributed to a reinvention of some kind?
Well, I mean, it's not like I don't have the sense that like we've reinvented something and it's caught on like wildfire and everybody's doing it for sure. But I think to make the show, I and the producers I was working with, like we did try to reinvent, like, well, what do you do in an hour of radio? And try to redesign it so it would be, you know, chattier. And that it would be stories, that it would be, you know, this thing that radio does so well, which is, you know, having somebody tell a compelling story, but do it in a way that would seem contemporary and not like, you know, old 1940s, you know, radio serials or something.
What will you be discussing during your appearance in Pittsburgh when you're up on stage and all eyes are upon you?
Well, basically, you know, I wander around the stage. I have an iPad and I can play clips off the iPad. Quotes from stories and the music that we use to score the stories and the ambient sound from the stories. And so basically, as I'm talking, I can recreate the radio show around me as I speak. And the talk is a mix of, you know, me explaining like how we make the radio show, why the radio show is the way it is, and where we find the stories and also just really it's an excuse just to play like amazing and memorable clips, a lot of really funny clips.
The first episode of This American Life aired in November of 1995 under the show's original title, which was Your Radio Playhouse. What was different about those early episodes, if anything?
It's funny because I was just listening to the very first episode to pull a clip of tape for a project the other day. I mean, what it's like is we hadn't really decided as a staff on like what would be in and what would be out. So there was a lot more experimentation. I mean, there was a lot more. There was a certain amount of performance art, actually, that was done on the show. It's like watching the early episodes of The Simpsons, you know, like where it's the same characters, but they're drawn a little wrong and the tone is a little different. And I think like it took a year or so, I think, like with any show, for us to kind of fall into a sense of like, this is the stuff we do better than anything else. And these other things are things that we're going to leave out. So the first year or two of the show has some real highs, but it also has some real weird stuff in there too.
What was the initial reaction, audience reaction to the show?
I mean, the actual like radio audience reaction was pretty positive from the beginning. You know, with a couple of question marks, like one of the ongoing question marks for years has been, me and the voices of the other hosts, like there was of the other contributors, like we'd have a contributor like Sarah Val or David Sedaris, and if people have heard them on the radio, like they don't have traditional radio voices at all, and in fact almost no one on the show had a kind of traditional sort of radio performance voice. And now we've been on the air so long, I feel like people are used to it and it's old hat. But the fact that I was hosting the show in the style I was, I mean, I had been an NPR reporter and a producer for All Things Considered, a Morning Edition. And I just remember like a lot of the program directors around the country who we were trying to convince to pick up the radio show, like they would hear the show and they'd say like, oh, Ira's a really good reporter and obviously a very good producer. But like, are you going to get a host? Like, can you afford a real host? And truthfully, we couldn't afford somebody like who, you know, would sound more like Robert Siegel. And the way that I was talking on the air was intentional. You know, I mean, I actually had to train myself out of sounding like an NPR reporter, which I used to sound like just all the other NPR reporters with this sort of more formal presentational style. And I tried to train myself to sound, again, just the way I speak when I'm really speaking, because I thought it just gets through to you more effectively, especially with these stories that are more emotional. And funnier. Like, it seemed weird to be doing a more formal kind of newsy presentation with stories that are so full of feeling. And so in general, we got a kind of general good vibe of like, oh, somebody's trying something new. Let's hear that. And also like, wait a second, somebody's trying something new.
I've been listening to the show, like a lot of people, off and on, going back about 15 years or so. My favorite episode is the one with Phil Collins talking about heartbreak. When you talk to fans of the show, which episodes do they bring up?
I mean, that one is definitely like a big one. And the reason why, I think, don't you have the feeling of like, oh my God, Phil Collins is such a nice guy?
Well, also the idea that you were, as you presented him in the piece, in the show, that he goes through the same sorts of heartbreak that everybody else does, experiences it in much the same way.
Yeah. I mean, the plot of that story is so beautiful, where one of our contributors, Starley Kine, basically gets dumped by her boyfriend and she starts immersing herself in breakup songs. You know, there's so many breakup songs, and she starts listening to them, and she finds the utter moroseness of them and despair of them to be comforting. And she gets to that phase after a breakup that I think a lot of us will know, where her friends are telling her, okay, time to move on, but she's not ready to move on. And she basically just kind of barricades herself in the house and listens to these songs all the time. And then she decides she hasn't gone far enough. She's going to write a breakup song. She's going to get inside the world of it so deeply because she's enjoying the wallowing. And at that point, she calls Phil Collins for advice. And he actually gives her really interesting advice about writing a breakup song, and then tells this story that's so crazy about how he had no interest in being like a singer-songwriter, and then his wife dumped him and he started writing these songs hoping to get her back, and that became his first international like best-selling album. And they have this incredibly very real conversation about all of that, about music, and it, I don't know, it's like the sort of thing where you never hear like a pop star talk in that way about their relationship to their own music, or rarely anyway. And so that's definitely like a favorite, but the stories that tend to be my favorites, I feel like, tend to be the ones that are the audiences that we hear from the audience too, you know, like, and they often are the big ambitious things we try. Like several weeks ago, we spent two episodes at this high school where they had 29 shootings in the previous year, 8 deaths of current and recent students. And we posted 3 reporters there for 5 months, and just to document what it's like in a place where you know, there's so many shootings, and what people in that situation know about that kind of violence and the aftermath of it that the rest of us don't. And I feel like, you know, my relationship to that was in a way the same as the listeners, where like I didn't know a lot about what it's like, And it was interesting to hear how super competent the staff of this public high school was, where they, you know, when they would hear about, you know, one shooting, we watched them kind of jump into action, trying to prevent a retaliation shooting and trying to protect their kids, and just super competent staff in a very, very difficult situation. And so I feel like, you know, those are the episodes that I feel like are the ones that are the most exciting to me, the ones that take me somewhere that I've never been and couldn't have imagined. There's ones we did on an aircraft carrier that was flying missions over Afghanistan, sending missions over Afghanistan. You know, the shows that we did inside Iraq during the Iraq War, same thing. You know, I feel like radio, when it's at its most powerful, the thing that it does so well is that it makes it possible to imagine your way into someone else's life.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is This American Life host Ira Glass. He's speaking in Pittsburgh on April 13th as part of the Hillman Performing Arts Series. Ira, it was a year ago that This American Life officially retracted the episode with Mike Daisy exposing factory conditions in China. even though the retraction episode became the most downloaded in the show's history, did you have any concerns about the show's credibility at that point?
Yeah, huge concerns. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, what happened was that I had seen this guy, Mike Daisy, tell a story on stage. He's a professional monologist. He's not a reporter. And he basically tells a story where he talks about how he loves Apple products and started to wonder about, like, the conditions under which they were made, and flies himself to Shenzhen, China, which is the city where a lot of that stuff gets made, and stands outside the factory gates and talks to the workers about this. They go in and out, and then supposedly meets with people, members of a secret union, and, you know, other people who have been inside the plants, and then gets himself into some plants as well. And so, you know, I had seen this as a stage show. It's an amazingly powerful stage show where he stands on stage and tells this to an audience. And then I approached him and said, like, is this true in the, you know, the traditional, like, is it strictly speaking absolutely true? And he said, sure. And I said, great. Well, then let's excerpt it on the radio and we're going to fact check it. And then we went about a massive fact check process that took weeks and found, I can't remember the exact number, either 12 or 14 people who had either been inside these plants or you know, were human rights, you know, activists who had been done surveys and studies of what goes on inside the plants, and ran everything he said about the conditions in the plants by them. And the one thing that we weren't able to check or that we decided not to check is that we wanted to talk to his translator in China just to confirm that it all was true. And he said, well, you know, I have this phone number, but it's not connected anymore. When I try to call it doesn't get through. And she's just somebody who I kind of met at the hotel, and, you know, I don't know how to reach her. And we're just like, well, okay, everything else checks out. And so we'll let it go. And basically we broadcast it, and a reporter in China heard it and heard, like, little details that didn't seem right to him, and tracked down the translator, was able to find her. And she said, no, like, most of this did not happen. And although the things that Mike Daisy said about factory conditions in Apple plants were true and had been reported by other people, the actual incidents that he described of, I went here, I went there, I met a person with a mangled hand who this had happened to him, those things were not true. Like, the story didn't seem to be true. And so... And so, of course, like, after we found out about that, we felt like we had to let the audience know. And to answer your question, yes, I worried, like, truthfully, I worried if people would listen to our show anymore after that. Like, I feel like that's a huge breach of faith and a huge screw up. And, you know, and just no excuse for it. I mean, when we couldn't reach the translator, we just should have killed the story, actually. And I worried that the show would end and for good reason, you know what I mean? Like, people would be right to turn away. And in the wake of that, I mean, we put into place, much more rigorous fact checking. I mean, we'd already been doing all the things that happen on the daily public radio shows, already we're an editor and a reporter, fact check things and go back over things and things like that. But we added to that, now we pay professional outside fact checkers, like, who work at the New Yorker magazine and things like that, who line by line go over every script in this process. That actually adds a lot of time and cost to making each story, but makes absolutely sure that nothing inaccurate gets on the air.
Abby Olheiser wrote a piece on Slate recently called "Is Ira Glass Becoming Too Famous for This American Life?" And she referred to Saturday Night Live's Fred Armisen's imitation of you. And she asked the question, as Ira Glass becomes Ira Glass, will his fame and public persona create a gulf between the show and its listeners that makes the kind of intimacy it has been so good at establishing impossible? What do you think, Ira?
I mean, that's not my experience of it. You know, I mean, I feel like most people still have no idea who I am. You know what I mean? I'm a completely anonymous person. And except in the small confines of, like, a public radio reception, like, people don't recognize me. And so, you know, and so it's not hard to get interviews with people that are frank and real And then in terms of like the relationship with the listeners, I mean, I don't know. I feel like the stories that we're making on the show aren't different now than they have been for years and years. And if anything, I feel like the stories are better. Like the whole staff is so good at their jobs and everybody does such a good job. You know, the people who I work with, I feel like the quality of the show has never been higher. Like there are more great stories and fewer just good stories. And, you know, and so I feel like, I mean, I would hope that for somebody listening to the show, for somebody who likes the show, like I can't imagine that there would be like a barrier to listening to the show. Like, you know what I mean? Like it just seems like radio is super intimate. It still seems like the same story is presented by the same people with me still there hosting. So I guess I would hope that she's wrong.
Ira Glass is the host of This American Life, and he'll be appearing in Pittsburgh on Saturday, April 13th at 7:30 at Shadyside Academy for Reinventing Radio, an evening with Ira Glass as part of the Hillman Center for the Performing Arts Series. Ira Glass, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a conversation with Steelers quarterback Charlie Batch, who's been honored by the NFL Players Association for his work in the community, when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.